There's a compelling argument for trying to settle space, that it could be a refuge if climate change cripples the Earth, that it could end scarcity and unify us, make us wise. But in their new book, the husband and wife research team, Kelly and Zach Wiener-Smith, say we haven't really worked through the details, that we're still in that fantasy myth phase of all of this. Like, we don't know for sure if people could make babies in space. And even if they did, we don't know if they could develop properly in a high radiation, high carbon dioxide atmosphere without Earth normal gravity. But set aside the biology questions for a second. The Wiener-Smiths say we haven't even worked out the economics or the sociology or the legal part of space settlement. They say the legal structures that govern space haven't been updated since the 1970s. And they say human spacefaring is almost always purely political. There's this weird little story in their book that illustrates this, where a Nazi soldier tries to Heil Hitler a penguin.
I was reading a book about Operation Deep Freeze, which is now mostly, you know, people don't remember. It was a late 1940s project by the United States, I think run by the Navy, to create the first permanent inhabitants of Antarctica. People had been going to Antarctica, I think, since the late 19th century, and the South Pole was reached in 1911. But it was always just sort of mad dashes or temporary encampments. This was like putting soldiers in giant fridges to see how they could set up tents and working out like eye gear and all the little details. And I came across this little reference to the time Nazis saluted a penguin. And as I recall, it was like not elaborated on. And you're like, how can you possibly bring this up without providing some additional detail? So I think Kelly found the paper, which was recalled, I think, in the 1960s about this attempt by a small group of Nazis on a boat. They showed up in Antarctica to stake a claim. Was going to be called New Swabia. I think that's the anglicization. It was going to be something like New... I shouldn't even try to speak German, but...
That's right.
Yeah, thank you. But so they literally, these Nazis show up, and the story recalled was that a penguin kind of waddles up, and just sort of reflexively being Nazis, one of them raises his hand and goes, Heil! And I'm not making this up. The document said something to the effect of the penguin being sort of unimpressed or impassive. Which is, you know, the appropriate response to this sort of thing. But what's nice, of course, is it also tells you what it was like. You know, empires were trying to stake claims to this place, which is part of what necessitated a treaty system designed to keep peace between nations in the post-World War II era.
Yeah, at one point there were three nations with a claim on Antarctica, sort of like pizza wedge-shaped claims that were overlapping.
Well, they're still there.
Yes, and so these three claims still exist, but we have still somehow managed to peacefully do science and coexist on Antarctica without fighting. And it hasn't been like the capitalist dream with tons of resource extraction or anything like that, but we've managed to maintain the peace. So we think it's a helpful way to think about how space could go, depending on how we decide to manage it.
Because that is the point, right? I mean, we've got to sort of work this out before we jump into things, I guess.
We think so.
We would love to see it worked out before we get there, but one of the other nice things about Antarctica as a story is that things were already starting to heat up. There were already these overlapping claims, some shots had been fired, but we were all still able to, like, pull back from the precipice and figure out a way to do it peacefully. So we'd love to see us figure it out before people are starting, you know, for example, settlements on the moon, but we still have some, like, wiggle room to figure stuff out, but we think the sooner you start talking about it, the better.
Kelly and Zach Wiener-Smith. Kelly teaches at Rice University in the Biological Sciences Department. Zach is a cartoonist. Their new book is called A City on Mars. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So the Wiener-Smiths are kind of in a tough spot with a book that debunks many of the ideas about space settlement because they consider themselves bona fide space geeks. They're just skeptical space geeks. And Kelly told us when they first started writing the book, they didn't set out to be party poopers.
We began thinking this was going to be happening soon, and that we would be writing the guide for, like, what are the near-term problems we need to solve as we take our first, you know, sortie to Mars. So the first trip to Mars where you then come back. And then as we build up to the stage of settlement, which we thought was going to happen in our lifetime initially. And part of why we thought that was because of research that we had done for our prior book, Soonish, which sort of introduced us to the space settlement community and some of the literature. And so we were sort of, as sci-fi geeks, we clung to this idea that, yes, settlements are coming. We're going to see this. You know, for over 100 years, people have been saying that. But now it will be true. And 2 years into the research, we changed our minds.
Yeah. Well, at some point, you started calling each other space bastards in secret. I want to get to the secret part, like why you thought you had to sort of keep it to yourselves at first. But explain what you meant about that. What were you finding out? It wasn't quite turning out like you thought it would.
Yeah. So I actually had, it's funny, after we turned in the manuscript, I was talking to a guy who was doing a book kind of about Silicon Valley culture, and he had come to a similar private name, except they called themselves space humanists, which I thought was funny. Kelly and I had maybe more negative feelings about our position in the relationship. But, you know, essentially, the thing is, excitement about space settlement, like, we don't say it's a religion, but it is a kind of strongly held ideology that binds a community together. And so there is a feeling like if you come in and you naysay non-trivial aspects of that, it's kind of like walking into a church and rolling your eyes or something. It's not just that you're disagreeing, it's like insulting to people because they've based their lives around certain ideas. And some of them were our friends, and a number of them remain our friends, but others don't. And neither I nor Kelly kind of get a rise out of that. We really are not confrontational people. In fact, we discovered at some point we're like having parallel anxiety attacks over over like having to take this position in the universe of saying, oh gosh, we just think you're wrong. And it was, you know, the funny thing is we also both had the same set of anxieties, which was extreme anxiety about sort of feeling like we were turning on friends or feeling that they would feel we turned on them. But that was overlaid by a deeper anxiety about not wanting to be wrong. And so kind of having to press forward with the new thesis that was more broadly negative. And so that, hence Space Bastards, because we really did, there was some part of both of us, I think, that felt like we were betraying people who I'd say it this way, if they had known what we would end up saying, might have been less generous with sharing their insights. Not all of them. Many of the people who disagree with us are like people we quote in the book and who really improved our accuracy and helped us. But other people couldn't go that far, and we regret it.
So you kind of lost your innocence as you were learning. You became more pessimistic. But you are still space geeks, which makes me wonder. You still can be a space geek and just not believe we should settle space at all or even just yet, right?
Yeah, I absolutely think that's the case. We are space geeks in the fact that we love space exploration. NASA does so many cool exploration missions, and I am not a person who cries often, but I remember getting up in the middle of the night to watch Curiosity land on Mars, and I sobbed like a child. Like, it's beautiful, the exploration stuff we do. And we'd love, maybe I'll speak for myself here, I would love to see space settlements happen eventually, but I think I would prefer to not have it happen in my lifetime, because if it happens that soon, we probably haven't done all the groundwork that I think is necessary. So yay for space, but yay for doing space sort of slowly and carefully.
So we'll get to the details here as we go, but we should maybe point out that you do think space settlement is possible, but as you say in the book early on, we have to know what we're getting into. We have to have these conversations about the truth and the reality of life in space. But you say we're not really doing that right now. We haven't really thought this through yet. Is that basically what you're saying?
I would add a slight nuance to that is a lot of like the sort of systems in terms of rocketry and engines have been thought about very deeply, right? And there have been missions that have planned very deeply. The part that is often elided is everything we call squishy. Right. So things like like all the biological effects are often kind of skipped over, like they're not a big deal by some advocates. Also, you know, reproduction paramount among them. And maybe we'll get to that. But even stuff like building an ecosystem in a sealed container is something we know very little about. And then beyond that, as you alluded to, creating legal structures that allow us to perform this expansion without threatening Earth, either through geopolitical tensions between nuclear powers or through simply enabling a large number of powerful countries and corporations and individuals to have the ability to move large, fast, heavy, dinosaur annihilating asteroid-sized objects around at will. We need a system that can handle all of that stuff, and it's just off. That's the stuff where we say we have indeed not thought this through, at least among the primary advocates and like powerful billionaires.
Would you guys say something more about the kind of space geek ideology? You mentioned a little bit about that, but how do you describe the ideology of the space settlement advocate? Because you say in the book, it's kind of libertarian and it's conservative. You know, they see the Earth as bureaucratized or homogenized. Like, what is the ideology here at play that you sort of see?
Well, there's a lot of variability, and it depends a lot on which community you're interacting with. And some voices are heard more loudly than others. So, you know, Musk's voice is maybe heard most loudly of all. And he's really excited about the idea of Mars as like a plan B for humanity. So a backup in case something catastrophic happens on Earth. And he's also really excited about this idea that you can sort of escape Earth's bureaucracy and start over on Mars, which technically violates international law that's been like standing since 1967. But you know, you get other people like Bezos is really excited about going to space as a way to sort of save Earth. So he'll argue that if you move population from Earth to space, and if you move industry from Earth to space, then you can lighten the pressure that we've been putting on our ecosphere, and that might help the planet in a variety of ways. And while I like that vision, I think when you start playing with the numbers, it becomes clear that space isn't going to save us from any of the catastrophes like global climate change that are bearing down on us right now. But, you know, and any group you talk to has sort of a different angle on why space is great. Some people say the resources in space are going to stop. We won't need to have war on Earth anymore because we'll all just have more than enough land and resources. The war scholars we talked to said that doesn't hold water. And then the overview effect is the idea that if you see Earth from space, we're all going to get along much better. We're going to appreciate Earth better. There's a lot of different philosophies, almost all of them positive, and it sort of depends on which community you're talking to.
So it's one thing to deal with the issue of making bigger and cheaper rockets and spacecraft. But as you say, it's another thing to deal with the more complex problems of, you know, and realities of human biology. So let's start there. What is it that space actually does to the human body? And maybe start with, as you write about this, the idea that all of the systems in our jiggly fluid-based bodies evolved, as you say, in this environment where there's this 6 billion trillion ton sphere called Earth. So start there, like how we evolved and then we'll sort of start working through the details about what it is that getting outside of this pillar of Earth means.
Yeah, so we evolved on this planet where we're all exposed to what we now call 1G, and our bodies are now used to having the cues associated with gravity. So, you know, when you step down, there's pressure on your bones and your muscle, and that pressure is important for making sure your bones stay strong and your muscles stay strong. And it's important, you know, your body has sort of acclimated to the fact that when you want blood to go down, you don't really need to do anything to make that happen. Mm-hmm. The blood just goes down because gravity helps you out. So when you go up to the International Space Station, for example, and you are in free fall all the time, you're not getting the benefit of that gravity. So instead of going down, blood tends to flow up. And that seems to cause some problems. So, you know, you have a face that looks puffy, and maybe that's bad for, like, social cues. Your face looks a little bit different. It's hard to read the cues. But it also appears to be bad for things like vision. And we're not 100% sure that the fluid shift is what causes vision changes, but we do know that astronauts tend to become more nearsighted the longer they spend in space. And we think that's because the fluid is putting pressure on the eyeballs and the nerves that go to the eyeballs, and it's just generally causing problems. So that's not great. We also know that that muscles deteriorate, and we know that bone deteriorates pretty quickly. And this is even with astronauts doing something like 2 to 3 hours of exercise, like 5 days a week. So astronauts lose something like 1% of the density in their hip every month. And most astronauts are only up there for 6 months to a year. And that's pretty quick bone loss. And so Mars has 40% of the gravity that Earth does. And so the big question is, how are our bones and our muscles going to handle that? Is 40% going to be enough to ameliorate the fact that our bones break down when you're not exposed to 1G? Or is it just going to slow things? Is it going to make that bone loss go down to 0.1%? Like, that sounds much better. But if that's every month, and now instead of a 6 month to 1 year stay, you're talking about developing and spending your entire life on Mars, it's hard to know how well our bones and our muscles are going to hold up.
Well, I mean, it kind of gets to the question of what happens to your bones and muscles, the lower back pain. The muscles, you say, shrink by like 13% after 6 months in orbit. And so there's also the question, like, how long does it take to recover from something like that, even if you're only up there like, 5 months?
My recollection is it's variable, and you have like measures like peak strength. So, as an example, in the Soviet program, I don't know if they still do this, but there's a long tradition where when people got out of the capsule, they would be carried like the bride across the threshold. And it's still considered very impressive if you can walk. Like, so John Glenn, for example, when he went up for the second time, when he was old, I think he was in his 70s, he comes out, he had a real chip on his shoulder about wanting to show that old people can still do stuff, right? And he told the story that as he comes out, he had to make sure he was going to walk. He was going to walk like normal out of that shuttle. And he'd only been up for something like a week and a half. And he walked, and he successfully did it for the cameras. And forgive me, it was either right before or right after he threw up in a trash can. Part of what's going on there is the weakened bones and muscles, but it's also something, I don't think we got into this too much, but you lose something called baroreflex, which is that thing where when you're lying down and you suddenly sit up, your body just knows to kind of adjust. But in space, of course, it doesn't do that anymore. You're used to this orientationless experience of gravity. And so your body just takes some time to get back to be able to do that. And what we found is, there are people who are able to really do this. And they also, they do exercise something like 5 or 6 days a week. And that's like on a treadmill tied to a spring to get something like impact training. But it's still very hard to get their strength back. They're at risk for breaking bones. I believe some of them said they would exercise in water, like as a kind of safe way to slowly recover. But some of them never fully recover their strength. So it's bad.
But isn't the idea of a, for advocates of space settlement, like, we'll figure that out. We'll find a, we can deal with the gravity part. But is the truth is, it doesn't seem like we have worked that out yet.
I think they might be right. So, for example, we could develop space stations that are constantly rotating so that they could, simulate 1G all the time. Those are going to be really expensive and very technologically complex, but they're not impossible. We could maybe do that. And again, Mars has 40% of Earth's gravity. So if you can get over that 6 month trip that it's going to take to get from Earth to Mars, and if 40% gravity is enough, then maybe you will be okay for the rest of your life. Or if you're born on Mars, maybe that will be okay. But I think it's an open question still.
Well, and also we don't seem to know about what all of this means for a developing human child. Like, what would this do to a 12-year-old?
We really don't know. I was at a workshop, and a medical doctor was there, and she was in charge of putting together the list of like technologies we might need to make all of this work. And her group was proposing that we might need to figure out artificial womb technology before we even start having babies in space. Because if you have an artificial womb, you can clad it in radiation-proof materials. Wow. And she and her collaborators, which they were all medical doctors, felt like, that's how big of a problem radiation might be. As a sci-fi geek, one of the things that bummed me out was I had imagined these amazing glass domes that we would live in. And, you'd wake up in the morning, and if you lived on the moon, you'd see the Earth through your window. But probably we're going to have to cover all the habitats in like a couple meters of this dirt called regolith that you find on the surface of the moon to protect us from radiation. But again, it's a problem that we don't understand very well.
That's Kelly and Zach Wienersmith. Their book is A City on Mars. Can we settle space? Should we settle space? And have we really thought this through? Take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. So sex, you say, technically works, like in a mechanical sense. But how does it work? We know a man can get an erection up there. Desire doesn't go away, you mentioned. But have humans had sex in space? Because this will, I'll give you a chance to talk a little bit about the sex space rumors.
Yes.
Yeah. So there are, of course, lots of rumors. The best of which is the supposed Three Dolphins Club, which was, I think, reported by G. Harry Stein. I should give full credit. We first heard about the story in Mary Roach's best ever space pop sci-fi book, other than ours, Backing for Mars, an absolutely deliriously wonderful book. So we actually pulled the original book she got from her, read the whole thing to get the section. And what it sounds like is someone pranked Stein by sending him a claim that secretly people on the shuttle multiple times had something like a space threesome, although the third member was actually there for like positioning purposes. I don't actually really understand, strictly speaking, what the third person was doing. With the funny part, too, and again, credit to Mary Roach for pointing this out, which is that they're called Three Dolphins on the idea that dolphins do this, that one is sort of positioning the other two. And I guess dolphins don't actually do that. So it's not even – it's bad science all the way down. A more plausible rumor is that there was – I'm blanking on their names, but there was a couple who secretly got married shortly before going up on the shuttle, secretly because NASA would have frowned upon it. And I think it was the Davises. I'm blanking on
the name. Yeah, I think Jan and Mark Davis.
Yeah. There's this old rumor going back to whenever that was released, saying, "Oh, they, you know, surely a couple of newlyweds." And people who are definitely wrong, like my wife, think that was a likely scenario. She thinks there might have been a like 7-person conspiracy to cover up the newlywed get together. I'll tell you why I'm skeptical, and then Kelly can say some wrong stuff.
So, this is the biggest point of contention in our marriage. Okay, go ahead, Zach.
So, setting the part we agree on, which is that nobody knows, right? There's no sort of confirmed evidence, and no, you know, you can't prove a negative. But like, so you could probably get all the way through like the 90s being pretty sure there was at least no man and lady sex, because there were basically almost never men and ladies in space together for long periods of time through the era when most space experience was in stations, and most of the stations were Russian. And now the reason is very few women went to space, and you know, you're talking about deeply homophobic cultures where you would have just absolutely trashed a career you had fought for if you'd gotten caught. Not to say it didn't happen. There's good evidence that people went to the bathroom, closed the door alone, and got down to business. But whether two people had that interaction, probably not. You know, so that leaves probably the shuttle era as the time to get away with it. But, you know, you got 2 weeks, you got 7 people in a vehicle about the size of a bus. So it's at least a pretty good sleight of hand or sleight of something to have pulled this trick off. And I would say at least requires a 7-person space sex conspiracy to have been kept under wraps for 30 years. Kelly, your move.
I think you lack creativity, and I think you just you don't know people as well as you think you do. That's all I got. We don't need to get into this too much more. I bet somebody has done it.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So I wanted to ask you about, like, there are a number of these space myths that you go through. Like, you know, will space travel make us more wise? Will it unify us? And we'll get to some of that sort of. But one of the things I thought was really interesting is you talk about how, and this seems like a pretty convincing argument, space exploration is a natural human urge. But here's your verdict on that. When you say that's probably not true, explain what you mean, because it seems like we all feel like we're natural explorers.
I mean, you could say that about cockroaches too, because you find them like everywhere. And this is why we call ourselves the space bastards. And also, like, so a lot of the people that you think of as explorers are not necessarily going out because they have this amazing urge to discover. Like, so for example, Roald Amundsen, he's a Norwegian explorer. He went out with his ship with a plan to get to the North Pole. That was his stated goal. And when he was about to leave, he found out, oh, there are two people who have recently claimed to have gotten to the North Pole first. And suddenly his exploratory urge to, like, discover, you know, the North Pole dries up completely, and he heads to the South Pole because that pole had not yet been conquered. And so it's not so clear to us that it's an urge to explore or to see a specific thing so much as an urge to become famous doing a particular thing. Also, there's a lot of variability. Like, some people do want to, you know, climb Mount Everest, and Zach and I are quite clearly not amongst that group of explorers. But just because there are some people that are very interested in exploration doesn't mean that we need to spend billions of dollars to support that. There are, like, professional mayonnaise eaters or something, and that doesn't mean that that's a basic human urge that we need to spend billions of dollars on.
What did you learn about psychology? Because you mentioned there's, like, usually kind of two lines of thinking when the question of space psychology comes up. Either it's not really an issue, or you're positive people are going to go stark raving mad. But you kind of argue for this third way of thinking about it. Take us through that.
Yeah, so there's this myth that a lot of people believe, which is that if humans are put in, like, a little space together, they kind of go mad and want to kill each other. And, like, you'll see articles fairly regularly that'll say the real challenge of a space mission is just being in this little space together. There's this quote that got passed around all over social media by, I think, cosmonaut Reumann, where he says, you know, if two men are trapped in an 8x10 space, all the conditions are present for murder. Well, here's the thing. That quote is actually really emblematic, because Reumann was quoting from a book as a kind of joke, and he had actually many times gone up to a small space with other men, and they'd gotten on fine. I mean, you know, people sometimes have tiffs and that sort of thing, but that happens back home. And so, you know, the myth that humans can't get along in confined spaces is just a myth, but humans have been doing it for a long time. There's really robust data, or fairly robust data. We wish it was sort of more scientifically conducted, but there are analogs in submarines, in old polar exploration, like in the 19th century and early 20th century, and in Antarctic bases of today, which often involve what are called ICE, isolated and confined environments. And what we find is when you have selection, you pick people who seem to be up to it, and also they select themselves to be in these places and in these programs, they seem to get along fine. What we searched in vain, for example, in space, of someone going crazy. We found two stories where missions got called off a little early, maybe for psychological reasons. But even then, it was usually in response to something. Like, in one case, it was because, like, they were in a spaceship in one of the Soyuz, one of the Russian space stations, and they lost power for, like, hours. Right? So it wasn't like someone just wigged out because he was stuck in a little space. What's that, Kelly?
I just said yikes.
Yikes, exactly. Super yikes. I mean, imagine in space. It's funny, you think, would you just die? And no, there's enough, like the oxygen system still works. You do have to move around so carbon dioxide doesn't build up around your head. But you don't die. You're just probably scared out of your mind. And so, you know, likewise in submarines, these are like crews that are very large. They go down for months at a time. They don't see the sunlight. It's mostly young men. And you can find anecdotes where people have problems. But even then, I don't think we found a single example of people just because they were in a confined space. We found, like, an example where a guy kind of, I think his wife had, you know, left him while, right before he went, and he was kind of freaking out. But it was about that. And you can go to Antarctica, and people can find anecdotes of where people got on each other's nerves. But what the data says is that they have a lower rate of psychiatric problems than the people back home, probably because of selection. But even then, you know, so that doesn't get you off the hook. And this is where we're kind of in a third way here, right? So we say, look, it's actually, we're sorry to displease all the people who think it's going to be hugely traumatic to do this thing. It just doesn't seem to be the case. However, if you're talking about a base with 1,000 people, say, you should expect something like a background rate of psychiatric problems. That'd be especially true if you're talking about generations. So you just have children born there who are not selected, right? So as an example, one thing I don't think we ended up putting in the book, and I could be wrong, in the Mawson expedition, which was an Australian South Pole expedition, I think 1911 to 1913, a bunch of stuff went wrong. But the main thing to know psychiatrically is one of the men, I can't remember his name now, but he, Jeffries, was it? Kelly, do you remember?
Yep. Sidney Jeffries, I think.
Jeffries had what was probably in retrospect a sort of schizophrenic episode. He was a young man, and he was just experiencing paranoid delusions. And one of the way you select out problems of that type is people who go to space tend to be older, right? A lot of psychiatric problems manifest early enough in life that you would just say, you know, you're a full person, you're wonderful, not the person we want to send on this expedition, right? So you need, if you're going to have 1,000 people or a million people, or you're going to have a permanent settlement, you need services for these people. You know, one of the things we didn't get into when we talked about reproduction is with all those problems we described medically, you should probably expect a higher than average rate of people born with, say, cognitive handicaps. We don't know for sure, but it wouldn't be surprising. And you're talking about an environment where it's so hostile, everyone's working all the time just to survive. Right on Earth, when people have special needs, we have infrastructure. We have people who can take care of them so they can have real lives. In space, you don't have that. So you are not off the hook psychiatrically just because people don't go mad in tiny boxes.
Will you kind of underline the point about hostile environments? Because this is one of the sections in the book is where do we put people in space? And, you know, ideally we talk about the moon, we talk about Mars. But just say something about Mars, for example, because you say in the book how, this is how you put it, how thoroughly, incredibly, impossibly horrible Mars is. So just how impossibly horrible is life on Mars?
Well, so as we've already mentioned, you're probably not going to have a lot of windows because you're going to be worried about radiation. So you're going to be living under a giant pile of dirt. And that dirt has a lot of other problems. So that dirt is actually what's called regolith. And if you look at it under a microscope, it's a lot more sharp and jagged than the sort of dirt and soil that you find on Earth. So you're going to have to be particularly careful to not let it get into your habitat, because if you breathe it in, there's some concern that it will scar your lungs and cause what's called stone grinder's disease, where basically lung scarring builds up over time and it's harder and harder to breathe. Additionally, that dirt has perchlorates in it. So this is a chemical that binds to your thyroid and messes up your thyroid hormones. And these hormones control things like blood pressure and heart rate. And we know that if you grow plants in soil that has perchlorates, those plants take up the perchlorates as well. So you're going to have to be careful to be removing perchlorates from your water and from your soil so that you're not, you know, encountering these endocrine disrupting hormones over and over again. Mars has 1% of Earth's atmosphere. So that's thin enough that you can't go outside without suffering from something like decompression sickness, where you get bubbles in your brain and in your blood and you would die. So there's no walking around outside and feeling the wind on your skin or something like that. But Mars does have enough wind to kick up dust storms that can cover the entire planet and can last for weeks and can make it very dicey to be living off of solar panels. So probably we're going to have solar panels supplemented with some sort of nuclear power, which you'll need to, you know, bury far enough away that you don't have to worry about radiation. And additionally, you know, it's definitely SpaceX has gone a long way towards making things cheaper to deliver mass to low Earth orbit. Presumably, they'll get to Mars on Starship eventually, but it's still going to be really expensive to bring mass with you. So you probably shouldn't be expecting to live in giant habitats when you get there. So it's going to be cramped. There's going to be fear about, you know, your habitat depressurizing, or, you know, have we really figured out the radiation shielding yet? What is this lack of gravity, of Earth-like gravity, doing to my bones? But, you know, on the other hand, Mars has water and it has a day that's about as long as Earth's. That's nice. It's far enough away from Earth that communication is going to have something like a 3-minute delay, or maybe even as long as a 22-minute delay when Mars is as far as it can get from Earth. So you're not going to be able to have live phone calls with, like, therapists back home or family back home. So you're going to be pretty reliant on the people that you went with. So that's a sampling of the struggles you'll have to work with on Mars.
Then the question that you write about is, how do we keep humans alive in space? Which gets to the kind of the pace of ecology. Something I wanted to quote from the book, you say this early on, that in order for us, of course, to get from here, you know, to there, we're going to have to develop these extremely complex biological systems, or at least come to understand them. And you write this, you write, we can do it, but at the pace of ecology, not venture capital. Explain what you mean.
Yeah. So to tee that up, the one thing Kelly did mention is that Mars is the best place.
And so it's as good as it gets.
It's as good as it gets. And I would say amply. And no place comes even close to being that good. And so you have to take that place and situate a garden in it, a substantial one. And the reason you do that is because the alternative is you have to ship all your food from Earth. It has to be very, very shelf stable, and it's going to cost a lot of money. If you can grow food to eat, that does everything you want, right? That converts CO2, which is in the Martian atmosphere, into oxygen and carbon in your plants, right? Which are, you know, useful things to have for a variety of reasons. It cleanses water. If you have a biological system, it uses human waste, converts it back into the system, which also should help you integrate that toxic soil, which will have to be cleansed, but could be integrated into your system. So you're getting oxygen, you're getting clean water, you're getting food. Okay, so how do we do this? Well, the truth is we don't really know. So there have only been a small number of systems trying to make a sealed ecology, right? Meaning like the only thing that gets into the system is sunlight. So the biggest experiment we ever got was in the early 90s, which was called Biosphere 2. So Biosphere 2 is often remembered as kind of a failure and a farce, but it was this giant, totally sealed greenhouse, sealed, they said, tighter than the shuttle. It was 3.14 acres, huge, right? An acre is about a football field, right? The gigantic sealed facility in which they built intensive agricultural systems and also like these recreated biomes, like a coral reef and a ghost desert and some other cool biomes. And whatever else you could say about it, such as like they made all sorts of trivial errors on like the animals they brought in. They had problems with mildew, cockroaches. But, you know, 8 people went in. 8 people came out. The women had lost 10% of their body weight. The men, 18% of their body weight. They had formed into like rival gangs that hated each other. At one point, 2 of them spat on one of the other ones. Like, these are adults. But it did basically work. And a lot of the problems are so trivial that they probably could have been fixed in a second run or third or fourth run. But the project was called off because of like financial and mismanagement reasons. And if we had that data, right, if we now had like 30 years of data running the system, it would be so valuable, but we don't. So all we have since then is very small facilities. We have, there's one in Japan called SIF, one in China called Lunar Palace, one in Europe called Melissa. They either have a smaller number of humans, not totally sealed, or they don't have humans at all. We need this. And if you want 1 million people, like Mr. Musk wants, we estimate if it scales linearly, which it might not, you need a greenhouse the size of 2 Singapores, right? That's where we are. We need a lot more science, and it cannot be gotten quickly because you're waiting on ecology to develop. Problems may arise a decade, 2 decades into the system that you wouldn't have foreseen.
That's Zach and Kelly Wiener-Smith, co-authors of the book A City on Mars. Can we settle space? Should we settle space? And have we really thought this through? We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. Space lock is, you're right about how it can be kind of broad and vague and needs to be updated. Is there motivation to do that, to go back in and fine-tune space law?
There is certainly motivation among some quarters. Motivation to get a treaty across the finish line, probably not. So part of why we have space law at all, at least some people think, is that we scared each other by putting these nuclear bombs in space. You could think of other law that worked this way, right? So like, you know, like the part of why we have the partial test ban treaty on nuclear weapons is because strontium-90 was discovered in the atmosphere and then in baby teeth. Right. So we had to scare each other first. But in terms of whether we'll get the law, so there has not been a treaty passed regarding space since I think 1975. So after the Outer Space Treaty in 1967, there's some sort of side agreements that elaborate the treaty. And so you have this huge gap in time, no treaty since 1975. And so what's happened is you have this setup where nations cannot claim territory in the sense of sovereignty, but they can, under the American interpretation, claim resources ad libitum, right? This has long been the American understanding. It was instantiated in the 2015 Space Competitiveness Act signed by Obama and an executive order from 2020 signed by Trump. And into the legal breach, right, has come this document called the Artemis Accords, put out by the United States, which essentially says our very libertarian understanding of what you can do with resources is what we are going with. Sign on. And where it gets freaky is that that document permits what are called safety zones, which are these kind of areas of not yet defined radius around bases that would go on the moon, where you don't have like a sovereignty claim, but you could say like, do not land here. This is our safety zone. And that's totally reasonable on a scientific basis, because like we know from the time we grabbed Surveyor 3, I think on Apollo 12 for the lunar surface, if you land near an object on the moon, it sort of sandblasts it with all that nasty regolith. So it's reasonable to say there should be a safety zone, but you see how it makes a kind of turf-like claim. And when you add that to the fact that there are only very small best parts of the moon, like the places that have water or there are places that get near perpetual sunlight, you have the potential for something like a turf battle, which is, you know, worrisome.
So toward the end of the book, you say, before we do this, the naysayers need some time to say nay. and I'm wondering what's that like to be a naysayer. There's a scholar named Daniel Dewdney that you mention, and he's infamous among space geeks, you say, for saying that really the kind of the best move or the safest move for humans is to just never create this major presence in space. So what happens when you become a naysayer? And is there going to be space and room for you to have your say?
Yeah, so Dewdney is an interesting guy. He's an international relations scholar who's also long been a space geek. And he is probably the furthest along on the negative side in the sense of we just should not do this ever. And I think that's a view that is depressing, but ought to be reckoned with. And I don't know how he feels about it. Our experience, so we have friends who are like polemicists who really enjoy being in the mix on an argument. You know what I mean? Really, really like going against the culture. We do not. We used to joke that we wish we had the exact consensus perspective and could just say, good news, everyone. You've been right all along. That would have been so much more relaxing. And I don't want to sound like bravado, like I'm like, you know, saying like, well, we're just so honest and brave. I mean, it was genuinely, genuinely stressful and anxious. And we are just not the people to be in this fight. We hope rather that other people pick up our arguments and go into the fray while we cower at home. But, you know, there is a kind of growing community. So as we were going to press, actually, a couple other books in a similar vein attacking other parts or some overlapping parts of the problem came out. Erica Nesbold has a book called Off Earth that deals explicitly with the sort of ethical aspects of this stuff. Jamie Johnson is a space philosopher at Wichita, has a bunch of great papers. There's one called a set called Myth-Free Space Advocacy in, I think it was in Futures Journal. Kelly, who's the one who wrote Astrotopia, which is a little
Mary
more...
Mary Jane Rubenstein?
Mary Jane Rubenstein, yeah, a book called Astrotopia, which is a bit more strongly ideological about the kind of myth aspect among tech people.
About and who's... Not Sherman...
Oh, Fred Sharman. Yeah, Fred Sharman's another one. So he has several books out, one called Space Settlements and one called Space Forces. So there is a kind of groundswell, which I think is interesting that it's all coming at once. Because we certainly, when we started on this, we felt like we were kind of alone. And we slowly started seeing more and more people working on this. So I do think there is a kind of movement. It's sometimes, I should say, and I don't want to be ageist, but it does feel like it's generational sometimes. Not always. And actually, we've had a lot of emails from people who've been in this business a long time, in the space universe for a long time, who are like, thank you for finally saying this thing I've been thinking all along. And so now there is a kind of groundswell. So there's a lot more room for the naysayers to naysay. The deeper problem is whether those voices are actually heard among like agency heads or people who are doing diplomatic work or people running large... powerful corporations who unfortunately often funding depends on the assumption that this stuff is urgent and part of a large Cold War that we're getting into.
You say this in the book. You say that if you could leave and build a new civilization, do you know what you'd do first? You'd start recreating Earth as we know it. What are you saying there?
You know, Earth has a lot of things that I think we take for granted. So international law doesn't do everything you want. You know, Russia did invade Ukraine. There were consequences, but the war is ongoing.
Yeah.
But, you know, we have made a lot of progress on human rights, and their international law has, you know, created a system where a bunch of us can bind together and, for example, sanction Russia for its bad behavior. And so, you know, we've got a lot of good things. You know, the World Health Organization helps you identify when there's an outbreak of a new zoonotic disease or something. We have a lot of institutions that improve our lives in a variety of different ways. And I think a lot of times when you imagine going somewhere and starting over, you just assume that you've taken all of the good with you and now you get to work on the bad. But you're probably going to need to create systems to recreate all the good things that we have here on Earth. And that's going to take time. And if you start from scratch, there's some chance you're, you know, going to mess that stuff up on the way. So I think people just maybe don't appreciate how great a lot of our institutions are, even if they're imperfect.
Can I just pile on that? Like a big part of what we're into is just this idea that, like, you know, a lot of the international law that has been built has been, you know, kind of wrested from our worst natures over time, right? We've been able to make a relatively peaceful world that relatively, maybe not as much as it should, but cares about the environment, cares about preserving peace, and a lot of people are just bored by it. They take it for granted. I think sometimes they're itching for change. They feel it's too bureaucratic and wimpy, and it's not sufficiently dynamic. And so they'll say, can we just trash all this and have something new? But you know, I think what you would find if people started a Mars civilization tomorrow is they would immediately be cribbing, if they were doing it right, from the documents we've created down here. And the better life we've created down here, when you compare it to what it was like for much of the 20th century, for much of the 19th century, for much of human history. We don't want to do without these things. They're not perfect, but they're really good compared to what we had before.
Toward the end of the book, you write about this anthem sung by Russian cosmonauts. I wanted to ask you about that finally, if I could, because the song refers to this dream that these explorers had, and it wasn't for, as they sing, icy blue space. It was for the green grass of home. Will you say something about that finally?
Sure. Yeah. So Zach and I love this song. It's like an 80s power ballad. and we dance to it at our house all the time. Huh. I should clarify that. So it is thought of as like the cosmonaut anthem. But I had the opportunity to speak to one cosmonaut. And when I asked him about it, he groaned. He was like, oh, everywhere we go, people play that song. Any like talk that you give, that's the song that plays when you walk in the room. He was definitely over it. But but the idea is that you go to space and, you know, you're surrounded by this sort of artificial environment. And what you end up missing are the smells of home, the sounds of home. You know, Zach talked about Terry Virts in his memoir, how they miss the sound of rain. When you read astronaut biographies when you read astronaut memoirs, they talk over and over again about how, like, when a resupply ship comes and you open it up and you smell the apples or you smell the lemons or you smell the onions, even. The Russians report loving the smell of the onions when they arrive. Like, just the smells and the sounds of home and the feeling of being able to, like, hug your loved ones that you've missed. This seems to be the things that astronauts report spending a lot of time thinking about and longing for when they're in space. The view from space is beautiful, but there's a lot to miss about home.
Kelly and Zach. Thanks, guys, very much.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Kelly Wiener-Smith, she's an adjunct professor in the Biological Sciences Department at Rice University, along with cartoonist Zach Wiener-Smith, are co-authors of the book A City on Mars, Can We Settle Space? Should We Settle Space? And Have We Really Thought This Through? Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. I'd love to hear from you. If you have ideas or comments or feedback, you can email them at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.